Hello, everybody. It's Political Rewind time. I'm Bill Nygut, back for another edition of the show. We've got some breaking news. We've got a lot of political news, campaign news to talk about. So we're going to get right to before we get right to it, a couple of announcements. One, you can watch us on Facebook Live. GPB News is the place you go on Facebook to find us. Join the conversation there or tweet us at Politics GPB. And Tom Faust, our senior producer, Robert Jimson, our producer, and I are getting set to make a big announcement about this show that will happen on Friday during Political Rewind. Join us because we've got some what we think of as exciting news about the next steps for Political Rewind. So try to stay tuned on Friday at 2 o'clock when we bring you our big announcement. All right, Greg Bluestein, a political reporter for the AJC, is with us. Greg, glad to have you. It's Wednesday, your day on the show.
My favorite day of the week.
Right across from you is State Representative Brenda Lopez. She's a Democrat from Gwinnett County. Hello, Brenda.
Hi, always a pleasure to be on.
Yeah,
as well.
We're glad to have you here. And next to you, Chuck Cook, one of the best-known immigration attorneys in the Southeast, I think it's fair to say. Chuck, you find your way into almost every big immigration story or case that's going on at any given time.
We try to be as much help as possible.
Right. And the founder and editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which not only brings you pictures of the dogs, the beautiful, most beautiful dogs that need to be adopted because it's one of Todd Rehm's passions, but then goes on to give you great political news. And as I always say on this show, Todd, among the other services you provide to us is you tell us about local news around the state that often gets overlooked by other publications. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Always enjoy
sure.
it.
Sure. All right. Let me start with a breaking news story very quickly. Greg, we now have a guilty plea. The second guilty plea in the corruption investigation that the feds have had ongoing for a couple of years now of City Hall pay-for-play scandal, Katrina Taylor Parks, deputy chief of staff, went to court today and pled guilty to accepting $4,000 in bribes from a city vendor. She said she would go on and cooperate with the government's investigation. She says she didn't realize that what she was doing was wrong at the time, but she acknowledges she took money. And her husband is implicated in this in some way as well, although he didn't appear in court today, the best of my knowledge. What's interesting is BJ Pack, the U.S. attorney who's handling this case, once again, he's done this before when they've had announcements about the corruption scandal. He said he didn't use these words, but you've only got a little more time to get to have a get out of jail free card. You better come forward now if you have information or risk are coming after you.
And you're right. He said that multiple times. That his office is open to anyone who wants to come talk. And the big news out of this is not just the guilty plea, but again, that she is going to cooperate with federal authorities, and we'll see how high this could go. Because of course the word is that this corruption probe is tightening its sort of noose around other figures in City Hall, and we'll see if it also ends up implicating Mayor Kasim Reed, who says he's done nothing wrong.
Yeah, it is astonishing, and you would have thought. I mean, this started long before Kasim Reed finished his tenure as mayor. Episodes have come to light in terms of how the mayor spent city money in the last year, especially of his tenure. But suddenly this dark cloud over City Hall includes not only the federal investigation, but allegations that he misspent city money, the mayor did on bonuses, that sort of thing. It's just kind of astonishing that considering that many people felt Kasim Reed left with a sterling record as having done a great job for the city and a reputation that would propel him to future political office.
I think there are also ongoing investigations regarding whether they complied with open records requests and all that kind of stuff. And I guess the lesson for would-be despots is to never let go of the levers of power. And because once it became clear, I think that part of the dynamic was that once it became clear that he was not going to be in office for the foreseeable future, a lot of the folks who may have felt a sense of loyalty or a sense of fear of his wrath have lost a lot of those fears. And so it's going to be, I suspect, probably a story we'll be watching for the next couple years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Does nobody learn a lesson? I mean, it's not like this is the first time this has happened at Atlanta City Hall. I mean, did they not read the newspaper? Do they not read history books? My gosh, just don't take money from people to do your job. It seems pretty simple to me.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to watch it continue to unfold and see where this heads. But as Greg Bluestein pointed out, there are people who wonder whether or not this does go all the way up to the mayor.
And this is someone who said he wants to run for higher office.
Yeah.
You know, he made it very, very clear in his final months in office as Atlanta mayor that he had aspirations to either run for governor or U.S. Senate one day. And that's got to be on hold for a little bit.
I would think so. I'm not even sure you could do it in 20. Brenda, could you turn around in 2020 and run? You have to even wait longer than that, assuming he's not implicated. And by the way, we have no evidence that suggests he will be. People are wondering about that.
Well, I definitely think that 2020 could have been a consideration. But,
yeah.
You know, but whether or not there's, at the end of the day, a real implication or even any charges brought up, it's still going to be something that's going to drag him along, even if he decided to campaign for something. So that's, it's still an issue. And I think we were talking off the air that, you know, what Chuck said, you know, don't people learn? But like she said, she wasn't even sure what was going on at the beginning. And I can see that, right? Because when we're talking about $4,000, and you know, that's what's going to put your career at risk. Who knows? Who knows what?
It's kind of selling yourself cheap, I think. That's fair to say. Greg, you had another interesting story that broke this morning, and it followed up a story you'd written earlier in the week. First, you broke the news that the city of Atlanta was going to invest pretty heavily in a multi-billion dollar plan to build a huge project in the Gulch, that downtown neighborhood right by Phillips Arena, down in the railroad yard, right? And that seems to be, the city seems willing to invest pretty heavily in that, am I correct?
Yeah, and by the way, that was one of my colleagues, Scott Truby.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you broke that.
He wrote the story saying that there's could be as many as 10-figure incentives, and these are local incentives that the city of Atlanta could offer. These are tax breaks. These are incentives. These are infrastructure plans to try to get this, the Gulch, which is this warren of mostly unused parking lots sort of sunken under downtown Atlanta in prime real estate location. It was probably one of the biggest sort of economic development sites in the city for decades now.
And of course, Brenda, the first thought on this is that it would be a great place for Amazon to locate its second headquarters. And there's all that speculation that that's exactly why it's being developed the way it might be, to lure Amazon in.
Absolutely. Well, I'll start off with that I don't appreciate it because that's been my cut through city of Atlanta, so that's not a good thing.
The secret's out.
The secret's out,
it's
apparently.
It's a great parking space. Is
it,
what it
is.
It's
that too, area. Exactly. So that's now going to be, you know, history. But definitely that's the word, and possibly, as we were mentioning, going into special election about that. And for me, again, the question is what are the exact incentives that we're going to get, and how does that counterbalance to the positive gains for the state in terms of actual employment?
Yes, and now you're moving toward the story that Greg had, and I know this is your story. If the city is ready to invest heavily their own money in helping make this project happen, and if there is this thought it could be for Amazon, the next logical question, which Bluestein asked the governor, is, well, doesn't that let the state off the hook? He doesn't have to have the special session Brenda was referencing to get legislators to buy in to create an even bigger package of incentives. And the governor said,
Representative, you're not off the hook. This could be a giant. I mean, look, this is the crazy part of this Olympics-like pursuit for Amazon. We keep on saying that because state economic development officials say there hasn't been a chase like this since the Olympics. It could end up being billions of dollars in local incentives and billions of dollars in state incentives. And so there could be a special session, you know, even before the election or right after it, depending on the Amazon's timing. And the governor's made very clear that special session is still on the table. And the weird part about this is the exact contours of what the public could be offering is still held in secret.
Todd, you're a political consultant when you're not working on Georgia Pundit. If you were had a candidate for legislature, would you be right now holding your breath, hoping, please, let's make sure Amazon doesn't move until after the election. We do not need a special session before the election, especially if you're an incumbent, if you're representing an incumbent.
Yeah, it would be a mild hiccup. What I'm more concerned about is whether the public really wants Amazon. In addition to everything else I do, I drive around the city of Atlanta a lot, and traffic has gotten astronomically worse in the last 18 months in the area I live in. I chose to live there because at the time it represented a moderate commute to just about anywhere. And now it has taken me 45 minutes to get 1 mile from my house to I-85. And I'm not sure if these things, like any other hunt, take on a life of their own, where once you get in it, you're just going to run through brick walls if that's what it takes. But has anyone really, given that we have historically low unemployment today and the absolute worst traffic that I've ever seen that makes the city of Atlanta unlivable, in my opinion, do we really want Amazon at this point? Has anyone rethought through this since the beginning when we got in?
Chuck, what's your vote?
Oh, I think we want Amazon. I do, because, first of all, it enhances the image of the city of Atlanta, state of Georgia, as a place to do business. And our traffic is bad here. But I grew up in New York. I've lived near L.A. I've lived in D.C. I mean, it's not as bad as it could be. And those cities managed to survive. Yeah, it's terrible. And I actually moved closer to the city, so I didn't have a bad commute. But I think what they're hoping to attract, especially something like the Gulch, is a live-in city. And that was actually one of the things that Reed had always talked about. He wanted people to move to the city of Atlanta.
Well, this would be a multi-use development. Right. We know very little about it. The sketchy outlines we have it would be retail, it would be residential, mm-hmm. It would be office space. It would be a city within the city.
It's a mini city. And that's what Amazon has long said. I think we are in the brick wall phase, too, where state officials, this could be Governor Deal's swan song. Everyone at the sort of top layers of state government seem to be all in agreement that we're going to, do everything we can to try to get Amazon. But this would be multi-layered. And in some senses, in a smaller way, Mercedes-Benz's new headquarters in Sandy Springs is something of an example, because that also included, from a different developer, but housing right there on site that potentially some executives will live in and just make a short walk. With Amazon, it's going to be a much bigger deal, though.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I agree that it's still the legislature would have to meet, regardless of what the city is offering. And for me, I'm in the camp of, yes, it's generally a good idea to bring Amazon and any sort of a multinational corporation like that into Georgia and into not just city of Atlanta, because it's still going to affect us statewide. But my question is, how do we make sure that what we get as a state and what we get as Atlanta and Metro Atlanta is worthwhile, not only as to the issue of traffic, but the issue of affordable housing, mm-hmm. that has always been is a concern now and can only get exacerbated. So, yeah, there's a lot of things to consider.
So, Representative Lopez, are you prepared to go back to your constituents and say, I'll vote for a big package of incentives? I'm willing to get tax credits that might be worth X billions of dollars, or you're going to have to think about that.
Oh, absolutely. It's still something to think about. I can understand why this is generally a positive thing to try to get, again, Amazon or any multinational. But for me, it's still a factor of what are those specifics? What are we getting in exchange for those incentives? And if all we're getting is 50,000 jobs, that's not enough.
And if I lived in Gwinnett County, for instance, part of my rationale would be not just what does the city of Atlanta get, but what does Gwinnett County get? And I'd want to be talking, I'd want to be talking in terms of transit to get so that people can actually work down there at the Gulch and live in Gwinnett County. If I were from South Georgia or North Georgia, I'd be saying, I got no skin in this game.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, Greg, let's turn to campaign news. You had a really interesting story on the money divide, really up and down a number of races on the November ballot. You've got some people with big, big bucks and others with smaller pocketbooks. What was the point of that piece, and why did you want to write about it?
Yeah, it's interesting just to point out the wealth disparity, and it's from both parties. Of the statewide candidates, there are eight millionaires, and combined they're worth more than $55 million. And several of them have, you know, this sort of astronomical high dollar wealth that they could use to self-finance their own campaigns, much like David Perdue chipped into his own Senate campaign back in 2014.
You said there were 6 Republicans and 2 Democrats whose incomes total $55 million. Pretty remarkable. Let's talk about a few of them. Brian Kemp is certainly in that category, right?
Yeah, he's worth more than $5 million. And that's sort of where we've seen this race play out in the biggest role, because Stacey Abrams, her personal debt has played a role in this campaign. And it's the target of repeated TV ads right now as we speak. And her net worth is about $110,000. And part of that is her liabilities are her credit card debt, her student loans, as well as the $54,000 she owes to the IRS. And what Brian Kemp and his allies are you know, playing up in a major way, and you're going to continue to hear this through November, is that she owes that money to the IRS at the same time that she made a $50,000 loan to her own campaign.
All right, so there's a big disparity there. Sarah Riggs Amico, the Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Chuck, she's done well. She's got a family. I think it's a trucking business mm-hmm. that she's worked in. Yeah.
She's got big trucks, too.
$12.4 million. You can do a lot with that money. And then State Representative Brad Raffensperger, who's the GOP nominee for Secretary of State, $26.5 million in his personal financial disclosures.
And he's already spent $1.5 million plus to get to this far in the first place, because he was a very kind of little known state legislature who's likely to spend a lot more in the next couple months as well.
I want to suggest that simply looking at the net worth number doesn't necessarily always tell you the whole story, especially when you have people who either own their own businesses or are in agriculture. Because a lot of that net worth is typically either in land or in other illiquid assets. You would be a fool to have a net worth of $5 million and have it sitting in cash in a little safe in your closet. You know, it tends to...
Well, you could get a loan on that, though, apparently.
You could, but you still have to not do stupid things. And I've had the good luck over the years to work for a couple of candidates like this, and the ones who amass that kind of money tend to think in terms of cash flow and what makes good sense. And none of them that I've ever dealt with would put more than 10% of their cash on hand into something. And so a $5 million net worth doesn't necessarily mean you could write a $5 million check anytime in the near future.
Yeah, I mean, most people are not going to want to spend their own money to run for office. They'll put an initial investment in, and that's to attract other money into their campaign.
And that's important to note what Greg said, talking about there's a difference between chipping into your campaign, as we had mentioned before, and starting off like the $50,000 that Abrams gave to her campaign, and some of these other candidates that we're talking about fully fund their campaigns to the tune of multi-million dollars. And so that's a huge disconnect that we have to realize, that there's a huge difference between, even if you have that $5 million and it's not all liquid cash, it's still something that can afford you to chip in a lot more than $50,000.
Right. So let's talk about the implications. By the way, I think it's important that you point out, Greg, that certainly money, personal fortune, can give you some advantages in a race. But you name a number of people, the most high profile of whom are Michael Coles, who ran for Senate as a Democratic candidate, the Great American Cookie Factory. He made a lot of money on that. He didn't get very far. He lost. Guy Milner ran a series of statewide campaigns, governor, Senate. He was really rich, and so money doesn't always help.
Jim Barksdale two years ago. So there's lots of examples. And then, of course, the counter example is someone like David Perdue, who was an outsider. He had a famous last name and a mm-hmm. famous first cousin. But who was an outsider who also used his personal wealth to help propel him. He didn't completely self-finance the campaign. He raised plenty of money outside of his own cash, but about a quarter of the money he ended up spending, I think it was something like that, was self-financed. And so, again, as we get closer to November, we're going to see more pressure for those candidates who do have that kind of wealth to dip a little deeper into their wallets.
Todd, I turn again to you. How much can this work against a candidate who's wealthy and is putting a good amount of money of his own into a campaign. Can the opponent use that fairly successfully or try to use it successfully against the rich guy?
I can't think of a time when I've seen it used successfully as a campaign issue. What tends to happen, it can be detrimental to your campaign, but the reason it tends to be detrimental to your campaign is somebody who has amassed a great personal fortune, the people around him tend to become yes men, and they tend not to have people around them who can quietly say, hey, no, that's a stupid thing to say. And some, you know, I often think of like Roy Barnes was a very effective governor, but part of his effectiveness was he had Bobby Kahn who could pull him to the side and have a conversation with him. The really rich guys who get into politics for the first time tend not to have somebody like that. And then their campaign staff is too busy cashing checks and spending their money to have second thoughts about anything that this brilliant genius thinks. and so the businessman turned politician who becomes successful is more the exception because of that, I think, than because it's a potent campaign issue.
So I'm more concerned not about, especially someone that has really made, and if that means multi-million dollars and they have made it on their own, I'm less concerned about them spending their money because it is their money to spend as they choose. My concern more is the reverse of what's happening, particularly as it relates, for example, with Stacey Abrams, that those that do not have that substantial means and don't come from those substantial means somehow are less worthy or to run because they do have personal debt that is actually debt that, you know, most of us have, present company included, the student loans that I'll have the rest of my life. And if that's a concern for me to continue running.
No, not the rest of your life, please.
I promise she went to law school, quite possibly.
Yeah, that's right. All right, we do have to get to a break. I do want to make one personal side note to something you said, Todd. You're right, when Bobby Kahn was at Roy Barnes' side, Kahn was the kind of guy who could say to the governor, that's wrong, let's do it differently. We all know Bobby Kahn at this table. We should also point out that Roy Barnes, after he shockingly lost his reelection bid to Sonny Perdue, if he was out giving a speech and Kahn was with him, he would introduce him by saying, I'd like you all to meet Bobby Kahn, without whom I could not have lost reelection as governor. Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows, you're all sealed inside, take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars, and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. The Georgia Supreme Court just delivered an opinion on a case that it didn't get as much attention as it might have. Maria Palacios was running for a state legislature, or wanted to run as a Democrat for state legislature. She was denied a spot on the ticket, on the ballot, rather, by the Secretary of State's office, which said she was not in compliance with a residency requirement under state constitutional law, which says you've got to be a citizen of Georgia, interestingly enough, for 2 years. She's been a citizen here. She became a U.S. citizen a year ago, but she's lived in Georgia much longer. She made an appeal. Her attorneys argued, no, she's been here for many years. So she really does meet the U.S. She does meet what should be a lower standard of Georgia citizenship. Well, she doesn't have a place on the ballot.
Well, this gets into language again. This is a lot like the in-state tuition lawsuit from last year. What does the word citizen mean? It was down to that. And, you know, the Supreme Court decided citizen means an actual citizen, not necessarily a resident of the state.
Right. And Chuck and I both know, what is state citizenship? We don't have such a thing.
There's nothing that exists, right? So they decided to say, okay, state citizenship is U.S. citizenship, and you didn't have it, and so you're not on the ballot. It's the first case of first impression, at least in Georgia, And I can understand why they took it up to the courts. But now we know what that word means. And I'd imagine she'll be on the ballot in about 2 years and 3 months the next time this runs around.
That's right. And it's also important to note, right, because we have so many first generation or even second generation of first-time voters or first-time registered voters here in the state of Georgia, of those I'm specifically talking about, of immigrant mm-hmm. background, again, present company included. And the fact that that is the interpretation of the court is problematic and something that we do need to clarify in statutory language to make sure that all the people that want to run, once they have become U.S. citizens, should be able to do so. And so long as they comply with state residency, which is a thing, we can't make up words like state citizenship.
Well, one of the implications of this, Greg, is that this is a lost opportunity for Democrats to possibly win an additional seat. We don't know whether she would have won for sure, but now there's no chance she can win because she isn't on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, it's another Republican held seat. She was the only Democrat on the ballot for House District 29. So unless there's a write-in candidate, Matt Dubnyk will return to the legislature, and it's another one of those seats the Democrats target. I don't remember how highly targeted that was. It wasn't as targeted as some of the suburban districts, but it was on the list.
There is also a strain within our governmental institutions of trying to avoid unnecessarily dealing with constitutional issues, and particularly the judiciary tries to stay away from things that are core to the legislature's ability to govern their own affairs. And the executive's ability. If you look at the resumes of the members of the Georgia Supreme Court, most of them have served at some point in an executive branch agency. And at some level, simply saying that citizenship is a political question that legislators and the executive need to deal with is a way of avoiding an unnecessary confrontation.
I don't think we agree.
No, I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, the reality is the word citizen is a very simple word. You know, what does it mean? And basically what Georgia now says is you can be a U.S. citizen, but you must have been a U.S. citizen for 2 years, not one, to become an elected official in Georgia.
Right, that's correct.
That seems to violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, but I'm not sure they argued equal protection grounds.
They didn't. And you know, that is problematic because, again, the issue is that, again, going back to there is no state citizenship. It's not a matter of what it means. It just does not exist. There's only one citizenship, and that's federal preemption law, and that is U.S. citizenship. So if we're trying to make up something else or we're requiring naturalized citizens to have been citizens at least 2 years, that's a different issue, and that is an equal protection
issue. Yeah, and that goes, again, to the legislature. They have the absolute authority to say this is what that word means, and they'll go from there, unless, of course, it violates the Equal Protection Clause.
But defining who is eligible to run for office and who is eligible to vote are at the core of the legislative
So long
function.
As it doesn't violate the Equal Protection Clause.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if we're saying anybody that's running has to be a citizen for 2 years, that's fine. Then it applies equally to everybody. But if you're saying if you're a naturalized citizen, you have an extra hurdle of time that you have to wait, that's treating people differently.
We're going to talk about immigration and some interesting stories that developed in the news in the last week on immigration in a minute. But before we do, before we get off of state news, Todd, I want to turn to you. By the way, you have a huge fan watching on Facebook Live, Paula Sedlacek. I hope I'm saying her name right. She says that she loves seeing George Pundit. She loves the dogs. Where else can you find things about Georgia history, American history, cute dogs, Jimi Hendrix? So she likes your work.
I also have some detractors on that page.
Yes, I know you do.
Online? I'm shocked.
All right, but let's look. Let's drill down. You had a very interesting, you've been following a story, a local story that I'm sure there are listeners in our audience who care about. The city of Macon is really going through a fiscal crisis that could have a significant impact on, among other things, whether they can keep libraries open. And I'll talk about that a little bit.
And so this is something that's been going on for roughly 6 months. And you say city of Macon, but you got to be clear, it's now
Macon
a consolidated
city county. They're one unit.
Macon,
yeah,
Bibb City County. And I think that there may be some extent to which that plays into it as well. The consolidation happened, what, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And so this is, you've got a relatively new political body dealing with a combination of sets of governmental functions and budgeting. And this has been a slow motion train wreck for probably 6 months, where it became apparent early in the process that there was not going to be enough money unless taxes were raised or services were dramatically cut. And this is, I mean, it's interesting because it's just like all of these federal government shutdowns we always see. Well, not always, but every decade or so, where you have everybody is screaming about what it's going to do to their department and, you know, how they're going to have to cut services. And it almost becomes a standoff between the agencies and the governing authority. And some of the functions, you know, I think libraries are important. I am a devoted follower of libraries, especially the little tiny ones on posts that are all around the state. But some of these, there was an article in the Macon Telegraph today about the paratransit portion of this, which is helping folks who have mobility disabilities get around. And having, being the husband of somebody who went through a protracted disability, getting around in a wheelchair is a very difficult thing. And that's one of those things where I can say that maybe the libraries are Chicken Little screaming that the sky is going to fall. But when you talk about paratransit and folks being able to get to doctor's appointments, dialysis appointments, stuff like that, it really becomes a major problem.
Of course it does. When you put it in terms that stark, it's very difficult to then go back to making the other argument. But I mean, from Greg, I think that two of the most important institutions that America has ever put together are the post office, thank you very much, Benjamin Franklin, and the public library system. These are enormous institutions for our democracy.
Yeah, and that's why the Macon Council has such a, the Bibb County Council has such a huge decision in front of them, because of this sort of impasse could lead to cutting, crucial public services. And it's not just in Middle Georgia. I mean, we're having similar debates on the county level all over the state. In Cobb County, had its own sort of crisis over parks and libraries as well, because the tax revenue from the Braves Stadium didn't quite realize as much as they thought it would.
What a surprise!
Yeah, shocking.
I want to say two things. One is that I think the Macon Telegraph is doing an excellent job of covering the various dimensions of this, and that's something that only a professional journalism organization can do, and that's very important. But the other thing is that going back to the libraries, you got to remember that the public library system, 2,500 of those public libraries were built with private dollars, mm-hmm. and it was really given a kickstart by Andrew Carnegie, who devoted a lot of his money to building that. And so maybe when you talk about the public library system, the best way to think of it is something that started out as a public-private partnership, and maybe we could trend back towards that.
See, I think it's a bellwether issue about what it means about taxes, as happened in Cobb County, right, with the whole library things. I think it affects people in that sort of personal, visceral reaction, which is why you tend to hear about it. And we don't hear as much when we cut back on our fire services, when we cut back on our police department, or where we don't give raises to our teachers or our firemen and women. So I think that just goes to show you can't continue to say we're not going to increase millage rates like Cobb has been doing and gloat about it, and then expect to keep the same quality services that is what government effective services should be providing.
All right. You'll keep us informed on that, won't you, Todd?
I will do my best.
How that develops. All right. Let me turn to, we're going to talk immigration for a few minutes, but before we do, I mentioned it before, Alex Thomas actually raised a question on Facebook Live that I almost put into the show for today and then didn't. He wants to know, do you think the teacher hunger strikes that are going on in the state are going to change the conversation of the governor's race back to education? It's an unusual development that a number of teachers and others in education have said they will strike for, it's a limited hunger strike, mm-hmm. obviously, but to call attention to the importance of fully funding QBE, helping make our schools better.
Yeah, and this is maybe one of the few areas, like the 10% of areas, where the two candidates actually are on the same page. They both stress that they would fully fund the QBE formula. But again, let's be honest. We've heard this from gubernatorial candidates for the last two decades who didn't do that. The formula has only now just been fully funded for the first time, really, in more than a decade.
16 years.
And Governor Deal ran for re-election in 2014 on a pledge to boost the funding and to restructure the formula as a whole, and didn't really get to the restructuring part of it. So both these candidates, both Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp, said they will fully fund the education formula, but both also think there should be some changes built into it.
No, but there are differences between the two candidates. I mean, Abrams has made it clear she's not just going to be an education governor. It's a public education governor. And that's what's important here. And not only about fully funding QBE, which we all wanted and, you know, has been harpered on again for 16 years, but we're talking about fully funding of an education formula from the 80s to fund 21st century education. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's a need for that and something that Abrams has discussed, and also reducing basically the taking away money from education by vouchers, which is essentially giving public taxpayers money to private institutions. And that is something that Kemp is for and Abrams isn't. So there's clear differences.
All right. I was just talking about the QBE part.
Let's talk immigration, Chuck Cook. We've got you, so it's good to have you here to talk about this.
I mean, immigration's in the news again. I'm shocked.
Yeah. Well, there were two stories that kind of came along at almost the same time. Both of them are negative stories. They're both stories that take the Trump administration to task for its policies on immigration. They're both really kind of interesting stories. First of all, we know that Stephen Miller is the president's closest advisor on immigration issues. He came to Washington mm-hmm. with Jeff Sessions mm-hmm. from Alabama and has been probably the hardest of the hardliners on immigration and whispering into the president's ear. Politico ran a really searing, kind of heart-wrenching essay.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
It was brutal.
By his uncle. And let me just read you a couple of sentences. The lead, his name is David Glosser. And he says, let me tell you a story about Stephen Miller and chain migration. It begins at the turn of the century in a dirt floor shack in the village of Antipole, a shtetl of subsistence farmers in what is now Belarus. Beset by violence, anti-Jewish pogroms, and forced childhood conscription in the Tsar's army, the family was driven out. And the patriarch set foot on Ellis Island in 1903 with $8 to his name, and the article goes on to describe the hardships that he faced in the United States, the family did, but there were protections in place. We haven't seen any reaction, I haven't at least, from Stephen Miller on this, but...
He never talks publicly.
Yeah.
Ever. You know, I actually wrote a blog about this in the summer of 2016 before the election is when you... get Trump, you get Sessions, and when you get Sessions, you get Kobach and Stephen Miller. Miller comes out of the Tanton School of Nativism.
What does that mean, the Tanton School?
John Tanton was the founder of the modern-day anti-immigration movement. Groups like Numbers USA, FAIR, Center for Immigration Studies, all founded and come out of his thought process, starting as an anti-population group, and then Matt morphed into a nativism movement on anti-immigration. And we knew it was always going to be about legal immigration. They raised the boogeyman of illegal immigration, which has not increased at all over the last almost decade at this point. But really the legal immigration aspect of it, and that's where we see these attacks coming. And that was that attack from his uncle. And now his uncle is a retired, I think, neuroscience professor from Princeton or one of the Ivy League schools. But he pointed out that this was about legal immigration. When you say, my dad can't come, or my spouse can't come, or my child can't come, that actually gets to the very root of who we are as a country. Our entire immigration system has been built for the last 50 years on the backbone of family-based immigration. Very few people statistically come in for employment purposes, but they come to reunite as families. And that was a searing, but a very touching, at the same time, reaction.
Yeah. You know what? Robert Jemison, could we tweet out that link to that Politico article? Because I think our people at Politics GPB, it's worth reading. Even if you think that harder immigration policies are correct, it's interesting to look back in history and see what the journey to this country meant to so many people.
You know, what's interesting about that is the most recent polls that have come out says that more than 70% of American citizens think we should keep or increase the amount of legal immigration we have in the United States. So it's very much contrary to popular opinion.
Greg, the other piece that pointed to what in this case the man who made these comments calls a hypocrisy in the Trump administration is Michael Wiles. He was Melania Trump's parents' attorney in their citizenship process. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have heard stories. We know we have every reason to believe that it was family reunification which allowed them to get green cards, which put them on a path to citizenship. And of course, Trump calls family reunification chain migration. He obviously condemns it. And Michael Wilds, after the citizenship ceremony. He was on CNN. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think I was surprised at just how strongly he condemned it. He said it's unconscionable, talking about the Trump administration's objection to family reunification. He says it's actually a beautiful bedrock of immigration law and policy, and it is called family reunification. I was kind of stunned that an attorney representing the president's wife would be that strong.
Yeah, and again, another signal that this is an issue that's sort of maybe at the underbelly. I mean, there's a reason why Democrats keep on bringing this issue up before the midterms, and it's because they think it resonates with the voters they need to maybe win back the House in November. And so we're going to keep on hearing about this.
Hey, if we're going to use their terminology, Trump's father was an anchor baby. So, you know, that's the hypocrisy of the message.
His mother, I think, is an anchor.
No, his mother is an immigrant.
His dad was the second generation.
His grandfather was deported from Germany.
Todd, what's your take on this? I mean, you're the Republican at the table today. Chuck Cook reminds me that he basically thinks of himself as a Republican, but on this issue, he's
aligns more with the rest.
Go ahead, Todd. Do you have any comment?
Yeah. I mean, I come from a family background that has a lot of, both of my parents are married to first generation immigrants. My grandfather came to the country illegally through the port of Seattle. Mm-hmm. He jumped ship. He was a cook on a Japanese steamship.
Wow!
And jumped ship into the. The port of Seattle, swam ashore, and was interned in Camp Minidoka during the Second World War. So, to ask me, what a normal traditional Republican thinks about immigration, my background's a little bit more complicated than that. But the one thing I can say is that my personal history tells me that we have made as a country some really goofy decisions, and immigration has in my experience always been very complicated, and complicated things don't lend themselves well to administration by the government, to standardization, and to sound bites.
All right. We got to get a break in. By the way, Tom Faust just sent me a bulletin. President Trump has revoked the security clearance of former CIA Director John Brennan. He had threatened to do that, saying that the former national security or other security agency people in either the Obama administration or even the Bush administration who were criticizing him on the cable news shows, maybe they should lose their clearances. Now John Brennan has lost his. Let's get a break in, and we'll be back with more of Political Rewind.
2018 is shaping up to be the fourth hottest year on record after three consecutive years of record heat. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sumini Sengupta, the New York Times international climate reporter, about the consequences of rising temperatures, including drought, famine, conflicts, disease, and increased migration. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We've only got a few more minutes left, and we have so much more to cover. State Representative Brenda Lopez from Gwinnett County is with us. Immigration attorney Chuck Cook, Republican consultant and founder and editor of Georgia Pundit, Todd Rehm, and AJC political reporter, the political reporter, in my opinion, at the AJC, Greg Bluestein, is here with us as well. All right, Greg, I'm going to start with you. So the Boston Globe last week announced that it wanted to send a statement to the White House responding to the president's frequent attacks on the media, calling journalists enemy of the people. More recently, the language has gotten more and more tough, mm-hmm. Saying that we're responsible for war, we're sick individuals. So the Globe has now got something like 200 newspapers across the country who've agreed that tomorrow they will all publish their own separate editorials, not on the news pages, but on the editorial page. They'll all write editorials responding to the president and stating the case that the news business is not the enemy of the people. I get it. It's very uncomfortable, and I want you to respond to this before we open it up. I find it very hard for us to put ourselves into a story like this. I mean, for one thing, who really cares about our problems out there? But there is a point here where the president has eroded, if we look at all of the polling, faith in journalists.
Yeah, I mean, it's a message that we are not the enemy. And Todd was mentioning the great work the Macon Telegraph was doing about the local budget crisis. And the same people that might boo reporters at a Donald Trump rally in Macon also rely on the Telegraph for that indispensable news. So it's a reminder that a lot of us, especially those outside of Washington that cover the day-to-day politics, education, sports, whatever the beats are going to be, are usually the only ones doing it nowadays. There's not the same media environment we enjoyed even 5 years ago, where there was multiple competitors for some of these big beats. And so we view, and again, we don't like PBS Story, but we view what we do as increasingly indispensable. And I think sometimes it's good just to remind our readers that, yeah, exactly that. What you're hearing out of Washington, whatever you might be hearing, we aren't the enemy.
Todd?
I will say that one of the most uncomfortable places I've ever been in my life is in the press corral at the Macon Trump event in 2016, because the crowd clearly did not like any of us. And I was bewildered because I'm like, I'm more one of y'all than I am these folks.
Do it to them.
I think there's a certain level.
That's called stereotyping.
I mean, ask any of Greg's colleagues; they'll tell you I'm not one of them.
Right.
I think there is a level at which a lot of times your local newspapers are the beneficiaries of the same kind of disconnect that people have with respect to their congressmen, where they all hate Congress and they all hate Washington, but they love their own congressman. If you live in Bainbridge, Georgia, your interactions with folks from the Post Searchlight are going to be different, and they're going to affect the way you view them as individuals, because you see them at the grocery store, whereas you don't see the Atlanta reporters around you unless you live in Dunwoody, I guess. And so there's increasingly what I think of as a separation of the small local newspapers and the big metropolitan ones, where they're sort of the middle ground is disappearing. Soon that top of the ticket, the large metro, may go away, but the local ones who cover school board hearings, I think they have a little bit more going for them.
So let me just give you some top lines from recent polling on where trust stands with journalism right now. Gallup did a poll in June, and just the top line on it is 62% of overall, U.S. adults estimate that 62% of the news they read in newspapers, see on television, or hear on the radio is biased. They think the news media mostly provides accurate information, but still estimate that 44%, almost half of what they see, is inaccurate. Now, Monmouth University, which is it's always thought of as a real gold star kind of polling service, they have done a poll that came out in April, and their top line is more than 3 in 4 Americans believe the traditional major TV and newspaper media outlets report fake news, including 31% who believe this happens regularly, 46% who say it happens occasionally.
It's stunning to me that people have been bamboozled in this way to believe that actual reporters who live down the street from them or go to the grocery stores or eat and breathe like the rest of us intentionally report things that are incorrect. That's just great salesmanship is all that is. That's bringing everybody else down to your level as opposed to really reflecting the fact, yes, some reporters make errors on occasion, but it's very infrequent. And I mean, every time I've had a chance to interact with the media, it's always been an opportunity to help bring education to the public to get the information they want shared more widely.
All right. Thank you. I'm glad you feel that way. I, Brenda, happen to think that we bring some of this on ourselves. I've said a couple times, this show has been an Omarosa-free zone, and it will continue to be. But the frenzy over getting Omarosa on your talk show to give her news about what happened in the Trump, a woman whose credibility is zero. Now, that doesn't mean some of what she says might not be accurate and proven true. But when we do things like that, I can't help but wonder if we're not contributing to our own problems.
See, but those things are two separate things. Yes, there's a I even have a concern, right, when we see, for example, what was termed as the CNN effect, the 24-hour, you know, you have to report something, and it's like one talk show host after the other repeating the same thing over and over. And, you know, is there not anything else happening? And that is problematic, but that is a far cry from saying that you provide false information. That you have purposefully inaccurate information. So those two things are separate concerns.
Of course they are, but they contribute to the same problem of perception.
Fake news has become something that a politician doesn't want you to know.
Well,
you
know? Let me give you another example. How many times over the last year or so have we seen major news organizations write stories, oh, the handwriting's on the wall. There's no way John Kelly is going to last another 30 days as a president. There is so much speculative writing, it strikes me, about what's really going on behind closed doors at the White House that doesn't do us any favors.
Yeah, and it makes it easier when it doesn't happen, when John Kelly sticks on.
But most of that's in editorial pages.
Or No, it's not.
In opinion pages.
Not at all.
Don't see it on the front page of the newspaper.
Oh, sure
it's
it is.
Going on.
It's there.
I think that newspapers are and the media overall are partly responsible for some of this, to the extent that they have willingly covered the president and other people trashing them nonstop. And you can make an editorial decision that we're simply not going to cover that kind of stuff.
Well,
they get so offended professionally by these characterizations that they feel the need to inveigh against them, when in fact the most effective thing you could do is just simply not ever mention it.
We didn't have a question about fake news until the president of the United States started this message. How is that possible?
That's the real question. But to get us back, and we're out of time, to get us back to what began this conversation, the Boston Globe effort, Todd, that's exactly why there are any number of newspapers that have decided not to participate, because they believe first of all, they believe it'll be futile because the people who are reading their newspapers are probably not Trump supporters. Yes. And second, because they believe they just feed the story in the same way that Trump feeds the story every time he tweets these days about Omarosa. So, look, we're not fake news, but in a way, I'd like to see us be more like Robert Mueller. Let's just take the hits and keep on moving forward. We're completely out of time. It was really terrific to have you, Brenda Lopez, Chuck Cook, Todd Rehm, and to you, Greg Bluestein. Thank you for being here. Tomorrow, by the way, really interesting show. Deneen Milner, one of the best-selling African-American authors in the country, here to talk about her life and career. And then we're back with another Political Rewind a Friday at 2, when we'll give you that big announcement. See ya.